The American journalist Barbara Walters said, "Motherhood is tough. If you want a wonderful creature to love, you can get a puppy." Welcome to the Mamafesto, the podcast that looks at where parenting and politics combine. This week, my guest is an extraordinary woman, Baroness Helena Kennedy. Baroness Helena Kennedy is a leading barrister and an expert in human rights law, civil liberties, and constitutional issues. She's a member of the House of Lords, the Chair of Justice, the founder of the Helena Kennedy Social Mobility Foundation, and she's campaigned throughout her career for equality, women's rights, and human rights in the UK and beyond. Helena is currently leading the gender apartheid inquiry into the treatment of women and girls in Iran and Afghanistan, and on the special task force looking at children who've been kidnapped from Ukraine to Russia. Welcome to Helena. I want to start just by talking about all the amazing things you did before you actually became a parent, just because it's extraordinary to me to think of all the barriers you had to break through at the start of your legal career. So just talk us through that to begin with, and the context in which you were operating in before you added children into the mix.
You know, it's still a source of amazement to me that my life has taken me on the journey that it has. I was brought up in Glasgow. My parents were really lovely people. Neither of them had the benefits of extended education. I became a barrister, which was a sort of wild idea for someone from my background. And there were very few women. You know, there were only 4% went into practice, you know, who got pupillages and so on. I mean, I was in classes where there were no other women at all. And at first I was highly intimidated. I thought that all these posh people who had marvellous voices and who'd gone to very posh schools sounded like the folk on the radio to me. So I assumed that they were brilliantly clever and that I was going to be found out for being stupid. And that awful thing that particularly women, I think, worry about. And then I started thinking, did he really say that? That was kind of stupid, you know, and you start realising that the veneer of sophistication.
Get past the rolled R's and you suddenly realise that it's all rubbish.
Yeah. So that came home to me. And then I had to find a pupillage. And I, of course, you know, it was all to do with connections and the old boys network in those days. And I had to bludgeon some poor man who had been the pupil master to a guy that I was friendly with who was in the year ahead of me. And we kind of, you know, captured him in a wine bar in Fleet Street. Elvina was in, and I then sort of made my plea to him to take me the following year. And I went back and back and back until eventually he succumbed. And he said to me, "You'll have a terrible time. Our chambers don't want women. They don't like women," and so on. And he was right. And of course, it was before the Sex Discrimination Act came in, which we were all arguing for at the time. And they said quite openly, you know, "We don't take women." And then it used to be, "We've got one."
A whole one.
Yeah, a whole one. And so it was quite hard to get into a set of chambers, even to do your pupillage. And then they treated you like you were the wallpaper, you know. You'd go in to collect your pupil master's brief. They were all guys. And the clerks would ignore you. And the clerks were all, that was part of the system. The clerks were all on 10% of the earnings. And they certainly didn't want to have women because they thought, "Oh, they're going to go off and get married and have babies. And that's not a good investment for us. Let's definitely not have women in here." And so the clerks, who were these working class guys who ran the clerks room and who used to sort of wheel and deal to get their barrister's cases off the solicitors, and who then would go down and get dates fixed that suited their stable of thoroughbred horses, as they saw them. And so they didn't particularly like the idea of having women. And all of that, I mean, the truth was that I got together with, I was in the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers. And we all got to, we would have meetings talking about the law and how the law worked. And, you know, you start seeing, if you've got an analysis of how the world works, and you start realizing it's about power. And I had quite strong class politics because of my background. My father and mother were Labour supporting all their lives. And so I got all of that. But what was new in the 70s was the women's movement. Mm-hmm. And I started going to women's movement meetings and being with these incredible women who were, you know, who'd read widely and so on. And we were all beginning to have our eyes lifted, you know, to the fact that, you know, it wasn't all class. It was also about gender, you know, and sex. And it was also about, you know, privilege and all manner of things. I mean, and what I began to see clearly, especially when I started going into court, was that law is an expression of power. You know, the people who've got power make the rules. And women hadn't been in there. You know, they hadn't been at the higher echelons of the judiciary. They hadn't been in Parliament. And it's why it's so important that there's women like you in there now. I mean, I never think of myself as a politician. I think of myself as a parliamentarian, because I've never done what you've done, which is standing for Parliament and going through all of that. Because at a time when I might have done it, I was up to my eyeballs in doing civil liberties cases alleging terrorism against the Irish, and some of them were innocent, you know, and I did miscarriage of justice cases, but also the horrible things that were happening to homosexuals, people who were gay, happening to black people of colour. It was the 70s, 80s, we were all involved in struggle. And, you know, it came out of the business of the civil rights movement in America. That was what led to the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland. People saying, well, you know, if people can be doing that in America because people of colour are treated as second-class citizens, why can't we, as people who are Catholics in Northern Ireland, why can't women be treated, you know, stop being treated as second-class citizens? And it gave us an analysis which helped us decide how we wanted to change the world.
So what you're basically proving, Helena, is that you had much better things to do than have to deal with the PLP and being MP. I mean, that's an extraordinary testimony to the work that you've done and the work you've done on human rights in particular. And as you say, already the bar was not a welcoming place for women. How did things change when you became a mum?
Well, I mean, I started having kids in the 80s. I had my oldest son in 1983, and then I parted from his father, who was an actor and who, you know, it just didn't work out between us. And then, much to the horror of my mother, the idea that I was, you know, living with a man and producing a baby out of my wedlock, that I was a feminist, you know, I was saying, you know, at that time, yeah, I felt very strongly, you know, why would one necessarily marry in order to have a child? And I thought we decided to have a child together, you know, but it was, he found all that very hard at that time. And so it was hard. I mean, I had, for a while, I was a single parent. I had a baby and I was on my own, and I was doing, by that time in the 80s, I'd been practicing at the bar then 10 years, and I was doing heavyweight trials. I was doing Irish trials. I was doing cases involving homicide. We were struggling to get justice for women. And I'd become involved when Erin Pitsey set up the Chiswick Women's Aid. We had sort of tried to think through, how do we get justice for women who are being abused by their partners? And it was terrible. You know, the courts would say, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, which is a nag. And if you were a nag, you deserve to be clouted. You know, it was really awful. And at that time, in order to get any kind of injunction, you had to start a civil action. So you had to get lawyers in order to sue your husband for assault, in order to get the accessory, which was the injunction. I did many of those cases. And I mean, judges started getting frightened if they saw me at a party and I spoke with their wives, came over to talk to me. They taking advice, you know. Anyway, but it was funny, but it was also terrible. I mean, it was hard.
And I say, I'm just interested in your experience of trying to fight all of that. But also, as you say, at some points you were a single parent, you then went on to have two other children, balancing looking after them and their needs and being. And forming a relationship with them, because that's also obviously a critical part of parenting, with trying to deal with the establishment, essentially, and deal with the very old-fashioned ways, frankly, that our judicial and our legal system works.
The bar and the legal profession generally is full of fabulous women who want to make a difference. And I'm working with some of them just now in the International Bar Association's Institute that I am the director of. Fabulous women. But the struggle getting there was that as women, honest to God, you know, there was no way you could go to court and say, I'm terribly sorry, I'm 10 minutes late because my childcare arrangements completely collapsed today because the nanny has got the flu and or whatever. You couldn't do that. It was far better to go in and do what the guys did and say, my car broke down on the motorway, my lord, and I couldn't possibly get here in time. Oh, child, you know, that was all fine. If you said it was anything to do with your childcare, I'm telling you, you brought down the wrath of the court. You know, you were supposed to function like the men, and they certainly didn't mention the domestic lives at all. You'd hear whispers when they were getting divorced or when they were having affairs, but you didn't. They didn't ever talk about their children. You'd think that they didn't have any. But that has changed. And, you know, all the young men that in my chambers and so on, they all, you know, want time off to be with their children, and they talk about these things, and they are our, you know, allies in all this stuff, thank God. So I was, you know, when I did my last book, I dedicated it. I acknowledged the wonderful women that are in my chambers and in the law just now. And I said, and the guys are not that bad either. And certainly not. we've got really good men in there doing good stuff.
So do you think it has become easier? Because obviously...
It's still a disgrace. I mean, it's still a disgrace in many different ways. I mean, look this week, the Guardian's been running a thing about the Garrick Club. Huge numbers of lawyers and judges, I mean, huge numbers, but significant numbers, certainly of the top tier, because the Garrick Club is hugely expensive. It costs nearly £2,000 a year to belong, and that's not paying for your dinners, you know. I mean, there's no way
that might buy you some nuts at the bar when you have a whiskey, I believe.
There's no way that it would interest me at all to be a member of the Garrick Club, but there are women who might like that.
You raised the Garrick Club, and I think that's a really
the Garrick Club
example, because it also reflects that power is accumulated. So absolutely, we can fight for a political platform. You can fight to get a place at the Bar Council. But being able to go to those clubs, being able to network, being in the right old boys club makes a massive difference. Yeah. And I think particularly for mums, the idea of being able to do the after work networking that is so integral to so many people's career progression is one that we don't think of it. I did try recently to talk about that as a motherhood penalty. The reality that if you're picking up the kids from nursery, you can't then take them onto the drinks reception to go and meet the judge to be given a more favourable hearing next time he sees you in court. I just wonder about your experience of trying to manage the out of hours part of the legal profession.
The legal profession, that business of drinking in wine bars and places after, you know, I mean, after the day in the court. And that's where you would hear where people would say, oh, you know, that big arrest that was made, you know, of all those folk, you know, a week ago, you know, the Hatton Garden robbery, you know, they're going to need to have a panel of lawyers. I'll put in a good word for you with the solicitors and all that stuff goes on in those social circumstances where women, I mean, as soon as I had kids, I was as soon as I could. I mean, and a lot of work has to be done. You have to burn the midnight oil, I'm telling you, preparing cases for the next day. But I wanted to be there to put them in the bath. I wanted to be able to read a story at bedtime and to hear how their day had been and what had happened at school and all of that. And I was married to a surgeon, and so, you know, his hours were often...
You weren't a particularly, you know, you weren't a family with time was probably not much on offer.
Passing the night. But anyway, it was, I didn't do all that social networking stuff. And to tell you the truth, I'm not any good at it still. Because I end up...
Eleanor, I don't think I'm breaking any confidences to say that you are a riot. When you go out and I've met you at receptions, I'm not saying that you end up dancing on the tables, but I know you are good value.
I do enjoy company and being with people that I like, and I love my women friends. I love having evenings with my women friends. So I don't imagine that I don't, but I just don't want to always to be about stuff to do with law, because I've got so many friends in other arenas, you know. But often, of course, now, I mean, we've had so much legislation here in the House of Lords that, I mean, you're spending your evenings here and you have to try and persuade people to come in and meet you here and spend time with you here. But listen, you know, We have gone on a journey, and what I often say is a lot has happened, but not enough has changed. I mean, that's the truth.
My experience has been that the concept of motherhood has been possibly one of the most contentious and most aggressive forms of trolling. Actually, I mean, I've been frankly quite taken aback by it. I think we judge women for how they mother whatever they do and however they do it. But particularly in these debates, and particularly when it comes to campaigning, it's been a real source of antagonism.
It was one of the first, Stella, it was one of the first things that I noticed when I was a young woman going to court, was this the business about, was my client a good mother? Was she a good wife and mother? And if she wasn't a good wife and mother, she was more likely to get a heavier sentence. I mean, in the stereotypes that were applied to women. Women who did not conform to certain notions of what good womanhood looked like, and I'm telling you, they
what was considered to be a good mother? What was the court?
That you would put your children ahead of anything that was in the public sphere at all, and working mothers were disdained, and women who were divorced, and there were all these things, and women who certainly had in their view too many men.
Too many men doing what, though? I think
it's very interesting, because on the one hand, you know, we know their attitude to women as sexual objects, as the receivers of their sexual interest, and yet at the same time be so disapproving and prudish about women who were deemed to be promiscuous. You know, I mean, you had to work hard to try and contain this notion that your client was promiscuous, because as soon as you were promiscuous, you'd had it. You know, I mean, we have come quite a long way in all of that stuff about women not having a sexual life or being entitled to to have sexual partners and sexual experience. You know, but I mean, at that time, that was the domain of men. Women were supposed to be somehow more precious, and we didn't have a sex life. You know, we were to be recipients of sexual stuff. They asked you things like, whether you had a fiance. You know, I mean, ridiculous questions were asked of women back in the 70s, and you know, even in the late 70s and into the 80s. You know, they didn't know how to interview people for jobs and for places in chambers, and women went through terrible things, and women of color. I mean, God almighty. I mean, you know, I mean, we complain, but all that business, and we now call it intersectionality. At that time, we didn't have a language for it. But even when I wrote Eve Was Framed back in 1993, and I'd been talking and been going on Women's Hour and things, complaining about the legal system in the years before. But when I wrote that book, I did it when I became a QC, because I knew that once I was a QC, it was much harder for them to say that I was just, you know, some resentful, bitter woman who, you know. And so once I was considered to be in that cohort of, serious advocates in the profession, acknowledged by her own profession, then I could see what was wrong with my profession and what was wrong with the court system.
You've had a career covering a huge amount of injustice and inequality, and also there's now the Helena Kennedy Foundation that's working on social mobility. It is an extraordinary story of challenging multiple barriers. I'm really interested to understand, what do your kids make of it?
Oh, my kids are wonderful. I mean, actually, one of the nice things is that I think they're great. And I always say to all my friends, I mean,
I really hope my mum thinks that too.
I mean, honestly, they are fantastic people. They're good people. They care about other people. They treat other people well. And people who meet them and know them all say to me, I must say, I saw Cleo the other day. She is, it's wonderful. And they are wonderful. And of course there must have been times when, they were disappointed that their mother wasn't there at the race day and didn't do a three-legged race or the, whatever, the egg and spoon race. I was never there for those things that were in the daytime, because I was, up to my eyeballs at the Old Bailey doing trials. But they somehow seem to have come out of it well enough, knowing they were loved and cared for, and that it was unconditional. And whatever they wanted to do, my oldest son's a personal trainer. My daughter has become a doctor like her father. It took her a while to make that decision. She went off down anthropology and Amnesty International and all kind of stuff. But she became a doctor, and she's now trained to be a psychiatrist. She's married to a guy who's a doctor, and who's also a guy from a ordinary background, but who's wonderful. And my my personal trainer son's married to a young woman who has the hard way through Open University has become a lawyer, a solicitor, and she's with the Crown Prosecution Service and doing lots of good stuff.
Be quite intimidating to have you as the mother-in-law, given all the things that you've achieved for her going into the law, to sort of, that's quite a challenge to meet that.
I'm a different person at home, I'm still the person that makes scrambled eggs and toast in the morning and stuff like that.
What did your family make of you going into the House of Lords?
Oh my God, my mother couldn't. I remember her coming in. It was so funny. My mother was a most remarkable and wonderful woman, and who did lots of good things. And as an ordinary working class woman, she was there. She helped people all the time, helped people who were experiencing domestic violence. I remember sitting on the floor, and I was always there with a book. And she used to have hidey places where she kept bits of money, because we had no money. But so she used to hide bits of money so she could go rootling around to find money when she needed it. And I remember a woman coming to her, and she had black eyes. She was a young woman who lived in the same tenement as us. And my mother going off and rootling around in the bottom of drawers underneath she used to line drawers with newspaper, because apparently that kept moths away or something. Anyway, and she'd give them fare to go back to her parents who were in another city. And, she was that kind of person. She was a good person. But my mother, honestly, somebody stopped her in the street and said to her, Mrs. Kennedy, I've been reading about your daughter. She does so many things. You must be very proud of her. My mother said, yeah, well, you should see her skirting boards. Somehow I fell down on the house cleaning bit of it. Her skirting boards. My sister was with her, so my sister heard this. But she also used to, somebody said to her, oh, what about your daughter being a lady now? And my mother says, oh, my daughters are ladies.
Good for her.
Yeah, she was, you could never get too big for your boots with my mum. and that's Glaswegians for you, So there's no way that I could have become some person that wasn't connected to the world that I came from. And also, because I don't think you can talk about justice without understanding the wider thing of our society. Social justice is part of that. If you're a judge who doesn't, don't understand that a woman coming in front of you who's the mother of a whole lot of children and, treating her in exactly the same. I remember a judge saying to me, I hear you on the radio and on the television talking about equality. Well, I'm going to give your client equality. And then you'd have to say, but hold on a minute, equality isn't about treating people exactly the same when they themselves are not the same and their circumstances are not the same. And having to remind judges that, if you're a single parent mother who's looking after kids because your partner is shoved off, is it any wonder that you might steal the knickers from Marks and Spencers for them to be able to go to school? Honestly. Knowing that and understanding the world beyond the courtroom door is vitally important for lawyers. And I always say it to when I talk to students. And here am I now, Stella. I'm now doing international work. And you cannot be a lawyer working in the in the field of international law, where I'm looking at war crimes and I'm looking at atrocity crimes and the horrors that happen around the world. What's happening, in the Middle East? What's happening in Russia, Ukraine? The killing of Navalny. Navalny's lawyers had to flee. His main lawyer had to flee the country. I'm in touch with him, but he's in hiding because you can be poisoned if you're on the wrong side of a certain Mr. Putin. So this is the sort of work that I've been doing now in my grand age and in my last chapters. And for me,
your book isn't even begun to be written yet. You've got so many more things, but you are, if I understand rightly, you're working on children who've been captured in Ukraine. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when the war started, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, had sought through his shift a cabinet to put together a task force on of international lawyers. And and I've had the good fortune of being one of the people who was involved in a task force with Amal Clooney, who's in my chambers, who's a really brilliant lawyer, but with a number of, you know, David Neuberger, who was the president of the Supreme Court. A number of us have been involved, and indeed the International Bar Association, in training lawyers in war crimes, training judges. I mean, we've, you know, training judges in war crimes. Why would you know about war crimes if you're a judge on the courts of Ukraine? And so, you know, I of course was looking at stuff relating to women and children, and so I've ended up heading up a task force with the my co-chair is the chef de cabinet, the right hand man of the president, and the numbers of children that have been, Russia would say, moved out of harm's way, out of the theatre of war, but basically taken out of, sometimes out of care homes or out of hospitals where children, after bombardments of their cities, ended up and their parents killed and so on, taken out and taken to Russia. And we're talking about thousands. And the issue is going to be about how to get those children back. And there's no shortage of law about, you know, the duties that there are for armies to take protective care for children and so on, but of course in the heat of war is forgotten. And of course I suspect that Russia wants to use these children as a bargaining counter for a negotiation at the end. You know, you give us this, you know, this oblast, this bit of our the territory that we want, and we'll give you back your children. Well, it's a disgrace to use children in that way. I mean, that is terrible. But many of them are children who were had disabilities and were in places because of their disabilities, or learning difficulties, and sometimes they're children who were whose mothers had cancer or something, and they were unable to care for them, and so it was very much that old Soviet thing of putting people into institutions. So there were lots of institutions and sort of boarding schooly type places, but basically where children were sent if there were problems in the family or anything, and those children were lock, stock and barrel put into buses and bussed off when the Russians moved into places. And so we're talking about thousands of children.
And it's an extraordinary story, and one I don't think people in the UK have really understood as to what is happening, partly because obviously we're in the run-up to a general election, and you know, the culture wars that are happening here and the fights for the who's going to be the next government. But this podcast is called The Mamafesto because it is also about what you would want to see on the agenda for the general election that might help parents, whether here or overseas. So, I mean, I hate to ask you to pick, Helena, because I know you have so many causes and things that you're working on. But if you could pick one issue to centre and say this needs to be part of the general election conversation, what would it be?
Well, I mean, one of the things is that we have to deal with this business, this continuing business of violence against women and girls. For me, it's one of the high priorities. While women are fearful, we can't enjoy equality. You know, it really is one of those burning things at the heart of inequality as between men and women. And we have to address it. And it's still there. And the extent of it is shown by what's happening on social media. And I did an inquiry up in Scotland into misogyny. And one of the things that came through to me was the extent, of the abuse that girls in schools and you're ugly and you're fat and you're all horrible stuff that's said to women. And then this disinhibition that people can say what they like on the internet has actually moved into the streets and moved into the public square. And it's why we have the ugliness of debate now around politics, but it's a debate around anything. The ways in which people conduct themselves, you know, young women came and gave evidence about, you know, they'd be with women friends, and they come out of a club or a restaurant late at night, and there'd be guys hanging around, and then they'd say, you fancy a shag, and you fancy, and speaking the most degrading ways about them, and commenting on their bodies, and all and women going home and crying. Why would you feel confident enough in the workplace to be asking for equal pay if you're being degraded and told you're disgusting by groups of men or young men who feel able to do that? And there is a sort of body of this going on online, as you know. And so I'd like to see us be much more vigilant about regulating this social media stuff. I also want us to, I mean, the idea of This is one of the other things. We're talking about fake news and stuff in the run up to an election. You know, the business of girls being presented, you know, as if they're taking part in pornographic film and stuff, and nude photographs of them are being produced. And you can do it. You can do it on your iPhone. And let me tell you, and guys are doing it, and young women are suffering the consequence of this in the most horrible way. I mean, the ways of holding women in their place have become even more sophisticated now. And so I do think that I want violence against women and girls to be up at the top of an agenda in relation to women.
Helena, I am absolutely with you on that.
Yeah.
And I am very prepared to come around and dust your skirting boards so that you've got time to keep campaigning and doing all the brilliant work that you have been doing on it. Thank you so much for being part of our Mamafesto today. And thank you so much genuinely from the bottom of my heart for all the work that you are doing. I know I speak for everybody listening this, that you are, frankly, at national treasure status.
Oh, Stella, I want
already
to say,
and rising.
I want to say something back to you, because you really have, of new generations being a leading voice in wanting change. And there are, you know, wonderful women in Parliament, particularly on the Labour benches, but across Parliament, who really are making the case for how society has to change and the ways in which support for women with children has to be much more available, and childcare and so on. You have been a really vital voice. And so when we're talking about national treasures, I think there's a club, and we're it's a growing club.
That means a huge amount from you, Helena, and I'm looking at my skirting boards now and thinking, I don't care about you.
That's what you have to say. That's what you have to say.
Thank you to Helena. I hope now you understand why I'm such a fangirl of her. If you'd like to find out more about Helena's work, you can follow the links in my social media to find out more about her gender apartheid inquiry. And always remember that social change is more important than the skirting boards. Hope you've enjoyed the Mamafesto. Please do enjoy listening to the next episode.